Russia's newest citizen, less than 1 hour old, greets the world at Maternity Hospital 11 in the capital, Moscow. Whatever the enthusiastic economists say, the future she has been born into is an uncertain one. Russians are dying younger and breeding less. Russia is shrinking, and that's no way to build a new country. I'm Peter Day, and I'm looking at BRICS, the powerful contention that Brazil, Russia, India, and China will all be top global powers by 2050. In this final programme, I'm looking at the things that could go wrong to postpone or cancel this date with destiny for one or more of the BRICS, and what it means for those of us elsewhere.
Our last delivery, approximately 20 minutes back.
Come on a tour of Maternity Hospital 11 with the chief obstetrician, Tatyana Fedotova.
A very good male, healthy, pink, wonderful male.
Russia's Security Council fears that by 2050, the population will have shrunk by one-third, from 145 million at present to about 100 million. 2050 is also the date by which the BRICS enthusiasts think the country will be one of the world's top dogs. And yes, Dr. Fedotova is confident the birth rate is turning round. Not there because parents believe the promise of future prosperity, the BRICS promise. After all, this is Russia, where the deepest fear isn't poverty, but anarchy.
I think more important is stability. Stability in our life, it means more. And now, I think in our country, stability very much better in comparison with 3 years back, and of course in comparison of 10 years back, very much better. I can tell it exactly because I saw eyes of our ladies in labor, hopeful in eyes.
In the back cafes of post-communist Moscow, the future has already arrived in an optimistic, materialistic rush. For the customers awash with international brand names, the BRICS predictions of a rich and powerful Russia ring very true indeed.
I think it's possible because everything is possible. Well, I see my future in Russia, and I think that Russia now is an emerging market and everything grows, as well as our salaries and our opportunities.
We work hard and people live almost the same life like in main cities in the world.
But beneath the glitter of Moscow, infested with Rolls-Royces, people tell me, is some deeply Russian gloom about a country fallen into the hands of a preposterously powerful few. These are the so-called oligarchs who grab so much of the natural resources which create the riches that puts Russia up with the other BRICS nations, at least according to those clever investment bankers at Goldman Sachs. Grigory Yavlinsky, now head of the liberal Yabloko party, is one of the reformers who tried to ease the Soviet Union's transition from communism to capitalism. What does he think of the thesis that Russia, as an economic power, will soon have a place at the top tables of the world?
For Russia, it's very important to answer some crucial questions.
What questions?
For example, what is the goal of the country? To what extent the country can make the people living in the country really free? To what extent country is prepared to respect property rights? To what extent country is prepared to respect human rights of the people? What kind of strategic development Russia is going to take?
Those are very big questions, aren't they?
Oh, it's a philosophical question of whole Russian history. It's the question where Russia wants to be a country which is following a European civilization of the second part of the 20th century. Or Russia is going to look for something special. Or Russia is going to be Asian country, maybe.
Can you fit the rise of the oligarchs who control so much of the raw material power of Russia at the moment into this potential evolution of Russia? What happens to the society you have at the moment, in other words?
As for today, oligarchic structure is making obstacles for Russia because over-monopolized economy, mainly based on raw materials, is not what Russia needed from the point of view of future development. I want to say even more. The strategy of oligarchs in Russia is in difference from, let's say, robber barons in America. At the beginning of the 20th century, the end of the 19th century, they were robbing America and investing in America. Russian oligarchs is robbing Russia and investing in Cyprus or Switzerland or I don't know where.
Next stop, Andrei Nechayev, a former Minister of the Economy, now President of the Russian Financial Corporation, the foreign investment arm of the Russian State Bank.
What has Russia in the pocket? From one side, what is always underlined by the Russian government, by the Russian opposition, by the Russian people, natural resources. That's true, but now we live in 21st century and it's not so important to have these resources. Much more important is to have money to buy them.
What needs to be put in place? What are the priorities for anything like this to happen?
So we need to support the high-tech sectors. We need to support the small business and to make the economy as much as possible independent from the oil sector. Then the Russia really has the great future.
Half a world away from Moscow in Brazil, on the much serenaded beach at Ipanema in Rio de Janeiro, athletic young men play impromptu volleyball under the gaze of bronzing lady admirers wearing barely a stitch of clothing. Somehow ignoring all this distraction from his airy flat overlooking the beach, Diogo Mainardi writes a controversial magazine column. He's skeptical of government pledges to help the 50 million Brazilians who live in miserable rural poverty or drug-ridden urban slums. He says the answer to Brazil's problems is certainly not big government. We're looking at BRICS, this thesis that Brazil, Russia, India, China are on the rise to the top table of the world economic arguments, and that the landscape will change very radically indeed in the next 50 years, and this country will be there alongside America. Europe almost disappeared from the scene. A complete change in the way we think about the business world, the economic world, maybe the geopolitical world as well. What do you make of that?
Well, I get that Brazil stay behind, much behind. We are far away still. We are a banana republic and we have to chew this country for many decades before we can become really a power.
Of course, there's Russia as well. Russia might drop off the BRICS thesis as well. So we're left with icks, aren't we, then? What you actually have, of course, when you look at the BRICS thesis is two great producing countries and two great raw material countries supplying the producing countries. That's what it's actually about. I think they've chucked Brazil and India and Brazil and Russia into the equation because of huge amounts of iron ore, soybeans and oil, haven't they?
Well, there is nothing wrong with being a supplier of raw materials. We can earn money with it. Brazil has tried to do everything else. He has tried to be an industrial nation. We're very far away from being a really industrial nation. Our industry is very much directed, subsidized, and it doesn't help in the long run, the charity of the state. That's the only answer we've imagined in the last 60, 70 years, and it doesn't work. So if we had some savage capitalism like China, it could work better than the way it is.
You're skeptical about the ability of Brazil to produce this that builds a great nation in 50 years.
I'm quite skeptical, yes.
If it happened, of course, other countries might have to move over. I don't know how comfortable that would be for Europe, say, which might disappear very much from the top table. Or America moving over and being challenged by the other engines of China and India. Not just challenged from the manufacturing point of view, which is happening here and now, but challenged from the intellectual point of view and the commanding heights of technology point of view. It's going to be an uncomfortable 50 years, isn't it?
Well, especially for you, yes, because you have something to lose. We don't have much to lose, so it will be less uncomfortable.
If the commentator Diogo Mainardi is skeptical of big government, the people here at the Brazilian Institute of Social and Economic Analysis mistrust market forces. Its director, Candido Grabowski, was one of the founders of the World Social Forum, the noisy gathering in Rio of non-government organizations and activists concerned more about globalization's burdens than the benefits that some people claim. Does Candida Grabowski think the BRICS predictions will come true?
It's possible, but it's not clear. I don't think China is sustainable. I've been there. It's not a sustainable society, socially and ecologically. India also have a lot of problems. Russia was a power in the past. I don't know if will be a new power. If you look to our exports, it's mainly nature we are exporting. We are exporting our future instead of building our future in this sense. And this is not sustainable. History is not going only for the good, can go down also.
There's a sort of assumption by developed world economists that democracy and freedom follows in some way economic growth, the rise of a middle class, the rise of a consuming class, the mobile phone, the internet, that democracy is kind of the next step in China, that uncorrupt democracy is kind of the next step in India as people get wealthier. Is that a reasonable assumption?
I don't believe so. For example, China is developing because it's an authoritarian regime. In democracy, it's more difficult to have this kind of capitalist development. We need more communication to have democracy, it's true. But alone, it not don't bring democracy. It's not enough. We have a lot of mobile phone now. I will not say we have more democracy. We need to implement democracy with land reform. It's better than to have more mobile phone.
The trouble is that sounds pretty idealistic for a Western economist trained in market forces, doesn't it?
Ah, yes. This is markets. Markets can be good if they are regulated. But it's like the wild law of the bigger, the stronger that will finish with the others. This is not democracy.
With all this skepticism in the air, it's time, I think, to go back to the fountainhead of the big BRICS idea. An artificial waterfall graces the lavish lobby of the Goldman Sachs offices in London. It's a long way from the slums of Rio or the long cold winters suffered by even optimistic Russians. I wonder if the economist Jim O'Neill, the man behind the BRICS proposition, has had to rethink his grand theory in the light of the messy realities of Brazil and Russia.
The more I delve into looking at aspects of Brazil and Russia, there are good things that are going on there which make them separate stories in their own right. Brazil could have reached its potential in the past 50 years. The reason why it probably didn't was because of simple things like very bad macroeconomic policy and hyperinflation. It's a lot easier for Brazil to get where it should have been. Similar story for Russia.
Ah, but look at Brazil. They're fading again. Here we are, front page of the Wall Street Journal yesterday. Development economists are puzzled by the way Brazil has faded yet again.
I don't share that scepticism. And in fact, even in Brazil, people jokingly say, well, why is the B? You only put the B in there because it makes the word sound good. Brazil's case, they've got the population, they've got some of the infrastructure, they've got enormous resources, and I think the doubting Thomases about Brazil may be in for a pleasant surprise.
Russia, you've just been seduced by endless visits to Moscow and this consumer paradise of Moscow bristling with brand names, haven't you? I mean, it's still a medieval country with baronies, fiefdoms, and such a lack of democracy, such a lack of real infrastructure, legal and political infrastructure. It can't possibly be a member of BRICS, can it?
I certainly think in the next decade, in this path to 2050, Russia's going to have it a bit easier. I don't know whether because the last time I've just been there, the sun was shining or I had some particularly nice caviar, but feels to me that Russia knows and the policymakers know what's needed to be done. But what they're obviously more aware of than we as observers from outside are aware of, keeping the balance of forces in support of democracy as they go through the subtleties of this process are probably more complex than many of us foreigners say. I'm actually slightly more optimistic than I have been in the past couple of years about Russia's ability to go through these very delicate challenges.
But not all of the challenges faced by leaders of the BRICS countries will be political ones. Although he now lives in New York, Suketu Mehta is the author of Maximum City, a book about Mumbai and about his native India, a place he still regards with awe.
The numbers are staggering. There's 1 billion people, and they're not motivated by the hope of economic advancement alone. Money isn't the most important thing to most of the people that live in India. Religion is vastly more important. Faith is more important. And when these people see attacks on their faith, they will ignore economic realities and they will go out to defend their faith. So these reports about India's dazzling success, India as the superpower of the 21st century, I hope it's true, but it's by no means certain.
A reminder that economics certainly isn't everything. Many people in the BRICS countries in this World Service series, Brazil, Russia, India and China, may have reservations about the prizes of capitalism and its torrent of consumer goods and services. In Moscow, Suketu Mehta's Indian misgivings are echoed by the Russian commentator and television personality Vladimir Solovyev.
I think that the coming years will be years not just for economics, but mainly for ideology. Whom you going to believe in? Liberal ideas, God as, let's say, Christians see it, or God as Muslims see it? And whose ideas will be more attractive, going to build the most powerful economy? Because funny enough, but that's the motivation of people to work at the very end. That's why America used to be and will be one of the greatest country, because their God is liberty, their God is independence, and they believe in it. They believe in the right to have their own opinion and to fight for it.
And Russia, what about Russia?
Russia will be great as soon as Russians will find the idea to live for and to die for. And it will be a threat to the world if we're going to find the wrong idea.
Vladimir Solovyev in Moscow.
11 days after Hurricane Katrina swept through the city, police and troops in New Orleans have started to forcibly remove some of the people...
But nature still has the ability to derail fragile human plans. Pandemics, such as new strains of influenza, for example, may throw the global economy into chaos. HIV/AIDS has already sapped the fragile economies of the worst affected countries in Africa, and that impact will go on for years. An even wealthier world is bound to increase pressures on the environment. The influential American environmental campaigner Lester Brown, founder of the World Watch Institute and the Earth Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., says that growth in at least 3 of the 4 BRICS countries could be overwhelmed by an environmental crisis.
One of the big challenges that China faces is the tightening water supply in the northern half of the country. This will obviously affect agriculture, but the water supplies could become so tight that they will affect industry as well. With Brazil, it's the deforestation of the Amazon basin that could be a suicidal sort of move if it affects the recycling of rainfall to the interior and the south of Brazil. India's problem is also a water problem. Water tables in India are now falling in most states. And when those aquifers are depleted, as they will be, as one Indian water expert said, there could be chaos in the countryside.
Why look at the future? Just look at what's happening today.
The acclaimed Indian water campaigner Sunita Narayan runs the Centre for Science and Technology based in Delhi. Week by week, she monitors the pressures of growing drought.
You had a firing that took place last year in Sri Ganganagar of Rajasthan, where farmers were killed by policemen because they were asking for water from the canal. You had a firing last month in the district of Tonk, where police fired on farmers because they said that this dam, where there was water, was theirs and should not be allowed to be taken to Jaipur, which is the neighboring town. Those are the tensions that are brewing in India. You have water today becoming one of your biggest limiting factors when it comes to industrial growth.
What about all the other demands on raw materials that the rise of India and China as wealthy countries will imply?
Well, I don't think there are simple answers to this. I think it's a question of how you manage it. I think it's very important not to look at the so-called BRIC countries in a very simplistic way and to look at them in terms of their own capacity to innovate. We need to be able to move ahead. Therefore, we have to be very ingenious in our solutions, and we have to understand there is nobody in the world who can teach us better than our own mistakes.
And there may be many such lessons ahead. The BRICS countries make up nearly half the world's population. And if the people in Wall Street and the City of London are right, then the growth of these economies alone will transform the appetites of 3 billion people. Many millions, at least of them, will all want hamburgers and pizzas and mouthwash and television sets and automobiles, more stuff, with hugely increased demands for energy and raw materials and space for roads and cities and airports. For international investors, a great opportunity. 3 billion new consumers. For the rest of us, worries about where we're going to find the oil, the energy, the raw materials, the food, the land to keep it all going. In a season when international oil prices have been reaching for the sky, that's the other component of the story of the rise and rise of the BRICS nations. The economist Jim O'Neill, the father of BRICS, concedes this.
Stories of blackouts around the world and enormous periods of pressure on commodity prices will be particularly prevalent over the next 15 years. And indeed, it might be that some of the security issues actually get escalated because of competing interests in search of energy. And I think that that will be a particular challenge, perhaps between the US and China in sensitive areas of the Middle East and Africa, and maybe Russia itself. And great diplomacy is going to be needed to manage those challenges.
The next 30 years are the really dramatic ones for change, aren't they?
I think that's right, particularly in terms of some of the negative risks associated in terms of the competing for resources and the changing nature of the way institutions should be run. And if we can sort out those dilemmas, I think if you can look through that and see 2040 onwards, it looks like a wonderfully prosperous world.
Wars, terrorism, epidemics, something comes along to throw the best laid plans off balance. But there's no doubt that other countries with big and clever populations are on the rise. Maybe it really will soon be time for the world's current top dogs to move aside or get ready to do so. The history books are full of great empires that declined, of economic powers that rose and fell, leaving behind wondrous ruins. This time, though, it's different. We live in a global world with global media. When and if the BRICS nations or something like them take over on top of the world, it will happen before our very eyes, live and in colour. Hold on tight.